Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Ah, the island of Lesbos. Welcome to Wednesday's programme. How are you doing? It's the 9th of September 2020. I am Richie Allen. Really interesting show ahead. Tweet the programme during it, of course, with your opinions. Let's do it.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, we've gotten to know Dr. Marcus De Bruin really well, haven't we, on this program? He's a Dublin-based GP, and he left the Irish Medical Council in protest over the way nursing homes were dealt with and handled during the onset of COVID. He's a whistleblower. They're going after him. The same medical council he resigned from has now initiated an investigation into him, claiming that when he attended rallies, he urged people to break guidelines. He says that isn't true. Marcus De Bruin will join the programme live in around about 25 minutes' time. And in the second hour of the programme, English businessman John Kirby is based in Stockholm, Sweden these days. He put a video on Twitter, it's gone viral, hundreds of thousands of views, basically showing this is Sweden, this is Stockholm, we didn't lock down, life is normal here, welcome to Sweden. So we'll have John Kirby on the programme in the second hour. So it promises to be lively, and I meant it when I said you're very welcome. Welcome to people who are discovering this programme. I have been informed by Raj and Jeanne, as mentioned from time to time, that when they see comments under videos and podcasts, some of them these days are from people saying they are fairly new to the programme. That's a nice thing. You're very welcome indeed. Well, well, well. Lots to talk about. We will come to Boris Johnson's remarks, which were only made about a half an hour ago. We'll do that shortly. The Daily Mail online today, headline, it screamed, Oxford and AstraZeneca's COVID vaccine trial is put on hold as British volunteer has serious reaction that triggered spinal cord infection. Worldwide trials of jab paused indefinitely after a British patient rushed to hospital. The patient is thought to have suffered serious spinal cord infection, according to sources. An investigation has been launched. That's a big story, right? Nothing funny about it. Other reports said the person has lost feeling in their feet and in their hands. Now then, the broadcast media, let's take Sky as an example, but do believe me, they were all in lockstep today. When interviewing the health secretary and other experts today, did they ask about the nature of the reaction? Did they? Heck. And it is hilarious to hear them. Hear them now skirt around asking the only real question the viewers or the listeners wanted answered. It's proper comedy gold, this. Here is a selection of Sky News presenters avoiding the very basic question. What happened to the volunteer? Ah, well. Shall we start with the Ginger Ninja? Here she is.
The Oxford vaccine trial has been put on hold, we're told, due to a suspected adverse reaction. How much of a setback is that for you, Health Secretary?
That's not the first question. But anyway, how much of a setback is it?
Well, it is obviously a challenge to this particular vaccine. It's not actually the first time that it's happened to the Oxford vaccine. And it's a standard process within clinical trials whenever they find something that they need to investigate. That's exactly what's happening right now.
Okay, but does it set us back in looking for a vaccine?
No, okay. No, you daft bint. The question is, tell us about the volunteer. What happened?
It does.
Not necessarily. It depends on on what they find when they do the investigation. As I say, there has been a pause earlier in the summer, and that was resolved without a problem. But what it does underline, I think...
Yeah, of course, you jump right in and you say, why was it paused in June, Health Secretary? What happened then? But not Kay.
Kay is that when it comes to the vaccine, we will absolutely do everything necessary to ensure a vaccine is safe as well as effective.
Yeah.
And whenever we find a problem that needs to be investigated, then we go and... then the scientists are going and doing that work.
Come on, Kay, so what happened to the volunteer?
Clear, whilst we're obviously enthusiastic about how important a vaccine will be, we're also clear that we will only introduce one when it's safe, and that... We'll go through that proper process because, you know, we want to get to a vaccine that is both safe and effective as quickly as possible.
Okay, we are out of time, but in the interest of fairness...
In the interest of fairness, go on, ask about the volunteer.
Fairness, I did ask you last week about Tony Abbott.
Not Tony Abbott, Kay, Jesus wept. Skip on 3 hours, lunchtime, Jane Secker, Sky News presenter. She got Doug Brown on. Doug is the chief executive of the British Society for Immunology. Here's her intro. Surely she'll find out what happened to the volunteer. Go on, Jane.
Now, human trials of a potential coronavirus vaccine have been put on hold after a volunteer reportedly suffered a serious adverse reaction. Researchers in Oxford have paused the trial while they investigate the suspected side effects. So, how great a cause for concern is this? Dr. Doug Brown, the chief executive of the British Society for Immunology, he joins us now. How usual is it for a trial to be paused in this way?
No way. Ask him about the volunteer. His answer?
Well, it's absolutely crucial that safety of a potential vaccine for any condition, let alone COVID-19, goes through really rigorous safety testing, and we make sure that a vaccine is safe and is effective. But because we have those procedures in place, it's not actually that unusual that we see trials like this pause. They're huge trials. This trial alone is looking to recruit up to 10,000 people in the UK to take part in the trial.
So good luck with that now.
Trials. So just by chance, it's not unlikely that a small minority of people will fall ill because of reasons unrelated to the vaccine. Though we shouldn't be complacent. We can't dismiss this, and we absolutely need to investigate this very thoroughly so that we can understand the cause of this adverse event.
The volunteer, Jane, the volunteer.
So how long will this delay the trial by?
Jesus Christ, eh? And it went on all day long. Honestly, listen back to the programmes. None of them said, what exactly happened to the volunteer? And I don't laugh because I think it's funny. Somebody has not got the feeling of their hands, nor have they feeling in their feet, and have a serious spinal infection. I don't find that one bit funny at all. Find it funny that they don't want to know about it, though. But that's the UK media. There's good news on the test and trace efforts, though. Buckingham Palace sent one of its horses to check up on efforts to train dogs to sniff out the virus. Here's the story.
The Duchess of Cornwall has visited a centre running trials to see if dogs can be taught to detect coronavirus. Camilla was greeted by working dogs at the Medical Detection Dogs charity in Milton Keynes earlier on. She then watched Cocker Spaniel Asher and Labrador Belle try to sniff out samples of COVID-19 alongside specialist trainers. If the trial's successful, dogs could be used to screen people for the virus in public places like airports and detect it even in people who aren't displaying symptoms.
What a beautiful future. You're not going anywhere anymore without a dog running up to you and sniffing your balls. Just to see if you're sick. You mightn't have any symptoms or anything. You might be fine, but there'll be a German Shepherd or a Cocker Spaniel running around you while you're walking through airports and presumably through town centres. Mad times. It's 12 minutes past the hour. Honestly, not a single presenter on UK television news today asked about what actually happened to the volunteer. That's staggering, isn't it? I mean, even if you've been on the fence and even if you've thought that I've over-egged the pudding, as it were, in criticising the media, surely you must be aghast that none of them wanted to get to the root of what happened to the person. No, forget about it. You know, God forbid that they do ask that question and then nobody else volunteers for the poison jab. The toxic tidal wave of shit that led to a person lying in hospital with a spinal infection. The other big story today you heard on the news, There's a few, but we won't get through them all. New lockdown rules, Boris Johnson flanked by Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance, two of Billy Poisonjab's gang. Well, gave us the highlights, the rules, the new rules, the new COVID rules for the autumn and the winter. Here's Johnson.
So we're responding and we are simplifying and strengthening the rules, making them easier for everyone to understand and for the police to enforce. I should stress that if we are to beat the virus, then everyone at all times should limit social contact as much as possible and minimise interactions with other households.
The opposite is true, of course, epidemiologically. Did I say that correctly? I don't have a medical bone in my body. What I do have, though, is I have a researcher's zeal for the truth. And I know for a fact that the opposite is true. The way to get rid of a virus is expose everybody to it. And when you do, lots of people will get it. Most won't feel bad at all. And eventually it runs through the population and off you pop.
It's safer to meet outdoors and you should keep your distance from anyone you don't live with, even if they're close friends or family.
Yeah, that's the end of your close friends and family now, if you don't live with them.
So, in England, from Monday, we're introducing the rule of six.
The rule of six.
You must not meet socially in groups of more than six, and if you do, you will be breaking the law. This will apply in any setting, indoors or outdoors, at home or in the pub.
Lovely. But there are exemptions.
There will be some limited exemptions. For example, if a single household or support bubble is larger than six, then obviously they can still gather. COVID-secure venues like places of worship, gyms, restaurants, hospitality venues can still hold more than six in total. Within those venues, however, there must not be individual groups larger than six, and groups must not mix socially or form larger groups. Education and work settings are unaffected. COVID-secure weddings and funerals can go ahead up to a limit of 30 people, and organised sport will still be able to proceed. As we found on previous occasions, this rule of six will, of course, throw up difficult cases. For example, two whole households will no longer be able to meet if they would together exceed the limit of six people. And I'm sorry about that. And I wish that we did not have to take this step.
But you were obviously compromised at some stage in the last 25 years. Videotapes, sound clips exist that would destroy you and your family if you didn't do it. That's about the size of it, really. But let's be honest about it.
But as your Prime Minister, I must do what is necessary to stop the spread of the virus and to save lives.
Yeah, to save lives. He then goes on to talk about enforcement. Listen up.
In future, premises and venues where people meet socially will be legally required to request the contact details of a member of every party.
Legally required now. So if you go out in future, pub, restaurant, it'll be the law that the restaurant or pub or venue must take the details of one member of your party.
Record and retain these details for 21 days.
For a month.
And provide them to NHS Test and Trace without delay when required. We will support local authorities to make further and faster use of their powers to close venues that are breaking the rules and pose a risk to public health. Fines will be levied against hospitality venues that fail to ensure their premises remain COVID secure. We will boost the enforcement capacity of local authorities by introducing COVID secure marshals.
COVID secure marshals.
To help ensure social distancing in town and city centres, and by setting up a register of environmental health officers that local authorities can draw upon for support.
COVID secure marshals to harass people in town centres and in parks. the SS basically, walking around telling people what they should and shouldn't be doing. It's quite extraordinary. And I don't have the soundbite because I was obviously rushing to get on air. But Johnson went on to say, and we know this because Hancock admitted this only last week, that they are developing rapid coronavirus tests which will deliver results in about 20 minutes. And that will result in regular, listen carefully to this, you can't believe what you're hearing. It will lead to regular testing of the whole population, allowing us to get back to normal life. Regular tests for everybody to allow you to get back to normal life. And what that means, not to put too fine a point on it, because we've said this so many times, that means in their dystopian future, which is only a few months away, you won't be able to go anywhere or do anything without the updated test. The weekly test result, basically. Right? No good that you got tested 3 or 4 weeks ago. You'll have to be tested weekly. And he mentioned theatres and he mentioned football stadiums and stuff like that. Without your consent, without giving into this, those venues, those avenues will be closed off to you permanently for the rest of your life. That's where it's going. Mad. He wants this to be available in the spring. The constant testing for everyone, for the entire population. Yeah. And when that fuckwit Beth Rigby and her fuckwit in crime Robert Peston and that goon from the BBC, what's her name, Koonsberg, when they got the opportunity to ask questions at the end of this briefing, of course they didn't ask the questions we would have asked about, you know, totalitarianism. Do you really expect us to live like this for the rest of our lives? Wasn't all doom and gloom on the media today, though. Dr. John Lee is a former NHS consultant pathologist, and he managed to get through the BBC filters today. He got on the Jeremy Vine show on BBC Radio 2. He said he believed that lockdown was wrong and it was scientifically redundant. Really? Said Jeremy Vine. Yes, said Dr. John Lee.
Yes, I do. Yes, I think the cure is much worse than the disease.
So I read an article in which you said that lockdown was enacted on a prediction of 500,000 deaths, and we've got nowhere near that, thankfully.
No. And in fact, the current numbers that we're seeing are following the form of the numbers that have been quoted throughout this debate, is that they've been given with no context. So we're told that 30 people or 40 or 50 people a day are dying of COVID. But of course, that's in the context of 1,500 people who die a day normally. And of course, while we're testing for COVID, we're not necessarily testing for other viruses. Often people at the end of their lives are susceptible to lots of diseases. So do they also have flu? Do they also have other things? We don't know. We're not told how old these people are. We don't know what their comorbidities are. So I think this is just a campaign really of partial information, which is following a given narrative for this, which we started at the beginning, and which is wrong.
All right, but even so, the key thing seems to be excess deaths, and we are at about 50, 60,000 on that, so far as I can tell looking at the figures, and there's only one explanation for that, surely?
No, of course not. Many of the excess deaths are to do with things that are not COVID. They're to do with what you alluded to just now, the excess cancer deaths, the excess deaths from, you know, suicides, other people not seeing their GP for other conditions, heart conditions and so on and so forth.
Is that right? Were suicides higher in lockdown?
Well, suicide rate tends to follow GDP. So as the GDP goes down, the suicide rate goes up. That's a very strong, well-known historical trend. So, yeah, I mean, these things have direct effects. And, of course, it's not just deaths we're talking about. It's also quality of life, the things that make life worth living. Seems to me we don't want the government telling us whether we can hug our parents or our grandparents. They can tell us the figures. Let us make the decisions on these things.
The 500,000 death prediction that you mentioned was quickly revised down to 250,000 and then revised down further. But if you question the people who came up with those numbers at the start, and obviously chief among them was Professor Neil Ferguson, they will argue, yes, that's what you get if you don't lock down.
Well, of course, that's the conundrum we're now in, aren't we? We're in the chicken licking style of government whereby the sky has been deemed to be falling and it's difficult to prove it isn't. I mean, what I would like to call for, I'd like to call for a public, open, televised debate on the evidence so that the public can see the quality of the evidence that's been used to drive this insane decision making.
Yeah, and so would Dr. Vernon Coleman. He's been calling for a public debate on this as well. Because you see, Vernon Coleman is obviously not alone. There you have Dr. John Lee, former NHS pathologist, dissenting, saying lockdown was crazy, no need for it, saying that the death figures have been inflated. It's all a nonsense, really. I don't know how he got on the BBC today. I have no idea. I doubt you'll hear him again. You've got Dr. Vernon Coleman, you've got him, you've got others, Hennigan at Oxford, you've got lots of them. But there is no public debate. 20 more seconds of Dr. John Lee.
The justification for lockdown would be if it was a very serious disease. It was something like the plague in the Middle Ages, which killed one in three people. This kills about the same number of people as flu do. And 95% of the people who it kills are in their 80s. I'm afraid we need a grown-up public discussion about death in this country. When you're old, you become more vulnerable to death and you die. That's normal. We've got to live with it.
Got to live with it, he says. Got to live with it. We've got to unlock and go back to the way we used to live our lives. Like I said already, you won't be hearing him on the BBC again. For those of you who want to print leaflets, do go to vernoncoleman.com. And on the left-hand side of the page, where it says health, click health, and you'll get a you will open a new page with lots of articles by Vernon Coleman. And at the top of that, you will see text. He's written text that you can apply to leaflets. You can make leaflets, basically. Using his text, he's talking about things like cashless society and other things. And I like the idea of printing off one of these and then running to a printer's and getting a couple of hundred copies printed off and then either handing them out to people in town centres or posting them through their letterboxes. So check this out at vernoncoleman.com. I think it's a really good idea. So kudos to him. Yeah, that's more or less it for the news roundup. Lots more going on. I mean, they've mooted curfews for the entire country. They are thinking about impositioning us with a curfew, a 10 o'clock curfew. They're looking at trialling this in Bradford, in Yorkshire. Honestly, a curfew. Because the virus doesn't come out till 10 o'clock, apparently. I don't know what the thinking behind that is. Well, I do, but I'm not getting into it. So they're talking about this for the rest of the country. But take this away from today's monologue, today's news roundup. Very important. They've now rubber stamped what Matt Hancock said last week on national radio. They plan to enforce or to coerce the public into submitting to regular testing. They said the whole population. And by doing that, you'd get back to normal life. And that would be complemented, the regular testing, of course, by regular vaccination. So there you are. So if you're listening to this, and you probably won't be listening to this, I wouldn't imagine, if you are of the opinion that the government is right and is doing the right thing. But if you happen to think the government is right and is doing the right thing and you're listening to this, surely now, surely at this point, you can drop the obtuse act and the stubbornness and the cognitive dissonance and say, Christ, this is not about a response to a virus. This is about changing human existence completely. It's about control on a scale that we, again, most of us couldn't have imagined. You can't sit now and say, no, this is the right thing. Regardless of which political party you're affiliated to, regardless of what you think of, you know, Keir Starmer, Boris Johnson, Jeremy Corbyn, you've now surely got to admit the game is up. You've buried your head in the sand and you have to acknowledge what's going on. Because if you don't, well, forget about it. The rest of us are fucked, basically. 27 minutes past the hour. Dr. Marcus de Bruin is in Rush in Dublin. He'll be with me on the other side of a tune. And later on in the programme, John Kirby is an English businessman who's based in Sweden these days. He put a video on Twitter. It's gone viral. And it's about welcome to Sweden. Look at us. Everything is hunky-dory. The train stations, no masks. The kids mingling. We didn't lock down. We didn't suffer. All very interesting. John Kirby joins us in hour two. As I said, Marcus de Bruin really 3 minutes away. Here's Miley Cyrus, believe it or not. Something new for a change. Miley Cyrus, Midnight Sky on the Richie Allen radio show. Vernon Coleman has been in touch. He's got a brand new video on brand new Tube this afternoon. So you'll know that he's migrated to brand new Tube. He's put his videos on there. And there's a brand new episode on there today. Do check it out. The video is entitled this fraud is now blindingly obvious. This fraud is now blindingly obvious. Right, VernonColeman.com for more info on that. Right, and I'm not sure we've got Marcus yet. We might have him. Let's try it. You'll know Dr. Marcus de Bruin by now because he resigned from the Irish Medical Council. He's a doctor based in Rush in Dublin in protest at how care homes were handled in Ireland. It's a scandal. And that was to his great credit. And since then, he's been pretty much a lone voice in Irish medicine asking very salient questions about the response to coronavirus. And according to the Irish Sun, the very same Irish Medical Council that he resigned from wants to now investigate him, alleging that he told people at a rally in Dublin not to adhere to the COVID-19 guidelines. I'm hoping he's there. Let's welcome back to the programme Dr. Marcus de Bruin. Are you there, Marcus?
Still alive, I suppose. Fair to Midland, would that be a good one?
Fair to Midland, yeah. I mentioned in the intro while I was calling you that you left the medical council to make that very important point about care homes. Now the papers report that you are being investigated by the same council because they allege that you took to a rally to tell people not to stick to the government guidelines. Is there any truth in that, Marcus? What did you say at the rally?
Well, no, there's no truth in that. I mean, I suppose to be clear, what's happened is that a couple of colleagues, I suppose you'd have to call them, or fellow doctors, have lodged a formal complaint with the medical council against me, and the basis of those complaints was that I was encouraging people not to follow the guidelines at a protest rally about 2 weeks ago in Dublin, which is entirely untrue. I when I appeared at the rally, first I have to say why I went to the rally. I suppose the reason I went to the rally was because, unfortunately, there's without a shadow of a doubt, or without wishing to sound alarmist, there's a real media lockdown in Ireland, and I don't know if it's the same in the UK, but it certainly is a real media clampdown on any sort of discussion outside of, on the other side of the kind of the collective narrative that people are being fed in terms of masks and in terms of the guidelines. So there is no place as such. There's no opening or no place. You know, we're not contacted by media sources, and media sources are not interviewing people speaking about the other side of the argument to masks. So the reason I went to the rally was basically the Irish government set up a COVID-19 committee after I resigned from the nursing homes. They set up a COVID-19 committee to investigate to look into the government's responses to the crisis. And the COVID-19 committee commissions Oxford University Professor Carl Hennigan's Department
evidence-based medicine, believe
Professor
it or not.
Carl Hennigan from Oxford University, his Department of Evidence-Based Medicine.
That's the one, yeah.
To inform the Irish government as to whether or not mask policy was effective, worthwhile, or was going to do anything. And he tendered a submission from his department, from Oxford, to the Irish government at the COVID-19 committee, basically telling the government, informing us that he had plenty of evidence and research to show wearing cloth masks are actually a health hazard to people. They're hazardous to people's health. They encourage disease. They're filthy, dirty. They're coated with bacteria and everything else. So cloth masks are a health hazard, and that there was no evidence to suggest that mask policy, that the other masks, wearing the other type of masks, was of any benefit whatsoever. And he said that fairly black and white, stringently laid it right out to the government's own COVID-19 committee. Well, the COVID-19 committee called our minister, Ms. Stephen Donnelly, to appear and hear some of this evidence, but he frankly just refused to go and didn't show up. So a lot of people in Ireland are very, very dissatisfied about what's going on with masks, what happened with the nursing home. So to cut a long story shorter, I went to this protest rally to point that out, that I am in complete agreement with what Professor Hennigan and Oxford University have informed the Irish government in terms of the efficacy of masks, and I continue to call perhaps pointlessly, but continue to call for a full public inquiry into the neglect that led to the deaths in the nursing homes. So that was the reason that, or that was the things that I was saying at the protest rally. And the reason I was saying them there is because, as I say, in my opinion and from my empirical experience, there's a media lockdown in Ireland, you know, in terms of, and that protest rally has been, there was about 7,000 people, anywhere between 5,000 and 7,000 people showed up in Dublin, but very, very strangely, it was really, really bizarre how it was reported in the Irish Times and RTE. RTE came out the next day and said that there was a couple of hundred people there and that they were from the far right. And the Irish Times did the same thing, a couple of hundred people there, and they're mostly made up of people from the far right. So now I've been accused of being a member of the far right, of being encouraging people not to follow guidelines. So it's a real kind of, it's a bit of a shit show, really. There's certainly a bit of a media frenzy in trying to kind of follow a particular political narrative, and people like me are being, I suppose, vilified and are being pursued, actively pursued now. Now they're certainly going after my livelihood as a consequence.
Your reputation, of course, your family. Yeah. Let me first of all endorse what you said. I followed it online. If Marcus de Bruin was on my programme lying to me, I'm no hard man or anything, but I wouldn't allow him lie. He didn't tell people what to do at the rally. What he did was exactly what he said. He took the opportunity to give information to the public that they are entitled to, information that is, that experts charged by the Irish government with giving advice on masks, Carl Hennigan, evidence-based medicine, Oxford, those experts said masks are useless. So what Dr. Marcus de Bruin did was exactly what he said he did. John Lee was the former NHS pathologist in this country. Very, very respected guy like yourself. And I say this because I went over you with a fine-tooth comb before bringing you on first time. And when you did come on, I had patients sending emails to me, patients of yours, people who know your family, couldn't say enough about you as a man, as a doctor, your decency, your generosity. What I want to know is, you had John Lee somehow managed to get onto BBC Radio 2 today with Jeremy Vine. And he said, the lockdown is a nonsense, he said. There's no need for the masks. This is crazy. It's killing more people. The deaths have been falsified. Do doctors like you, John Lee Hennigan, do you need to form some sort of group or some sort of action group? Or am I talking through my arse? Is that possible that you can come together?
I think you're talking through your arse, really, but I think you're talking through your arse with the best intentions possible, with people's best interests at heart. And I think I'm kind of getting a bit browned off talking through my arse too, because at the end of the day, what we're saying, this, we're all kind of those who are objecting to what's going on. You see, I suppose, you know, people are saying, well, why would the government be having us wear masks when we don't need to wear masks? And why would they, should the government people have to wear them as well? And so what's the motive here? So people are missing what the motive is. And when they don't see a motive, then they don't see a kind of a cause or a reasoning to what people like me or people like yourself might be saying. But the motive, at least from the Irish perspective, is perfect. Clear. I mean, we had somewhere in the region of 1,000 elderly people die in Irish nursing homes. We're second highest on planet Earth, next to Canada, in the world for nursing home deaths. So things went drastically wrong here, and the government does not wish to have any degree of revision. So what's kind of going on at the moment is we're being pushed down a certain road along a certain narrative, and we're being pushed into a scenario where the dialogue and the discussion is about masks and masks on buses and the efficacy of masks. And unfortunately, the 1,000 or so elderly residents of nursing homes who have died, they've gone off the agenda. And there's a very effective smoke screen up now from the political establishment that has people talking, doing exactly what you and I are doing now, talking about, you know, the rally and the masks and that sort of thing, and not talking about the horrific mistakes that have been made and the terrible consequences of those mistakes. So if people could join the dots and see that that's where this motive is coming from, that any degree of revision any degree of revision comes with the implicit suggestion that mistakes were made. Well, in an Irish context, and I'm sure in the UK context, but certainly in an Irish context, horrific mistakes were made, horrific mistakes that resulted in the deaths of hundreds of people. So there is a real essential motive to have us conversing about, have a dialogue about whether masks work or don't work, and keep pushing us down this road. You know, so there's that side of it, and then there's the other side of it. I mean, as I said at the outset, there's a media blackout for any rational person to kind of have a discussion about the other side of this, whether Sweden got it right, whether there is any truth in mask policy. I mean, Professor Hennigan's his report was issued to the Irish government itself. I mean, that's to the COVID-19 committee. What's not kind of tin hat wearing stuff. But even that is not in the public domain. It's not being talked about. So, you know, there's that issue. And then there's the other issue of, you know, the pharmaceutical company influence here. You know, one doctor in Ireland, or one professor in Ireland, who has an open season ticket in the public media is Professor Luke O'Neill, who owns a pharmaceutical company called Citrix. He's a co-founder of that pharmaceutical company, and he's on the radio every week. He has a weekly talk show on national radio in Ireland where he's pushing masks and pushing vaccines and pushing these things. So, you know, not only is there a media lockdown, not only is there a political motive to that lockdown, but certain sectors of the business community, viz. The pharmaceutical companies, are capitalizing on that, moving in and capitalizing on that by essentially feeding into the fear and the frenzy and the panic and everything. So, you know, it's not a very, very nice place to be in Ireland at the moment. And I don't just say that from the perspective of my own being kind of hunted down or being pursued by the medical council on kind of bogus charges of this sort of thing. But, you know, we're in a very, very bad place. And yes, essentially, you will be considered talking out your arse, and so will I be considered talking out our arse. And I think that the main reason for that is that the fear that's out there, these other people with particular agendas, government is able to kind of whitewash the deaths in nursing homes because of mass psychogenic fear, and pharmaceutical companies are able to capitalize on this by insisting on mass vaccination of entire populations for a disease that doesn't affect young people, doesn't affect healthy people. You know, these situations are being capitalized on, not so much because of what you and I are constantly trying to, and people like us are constantly trying to point out, the other side of the argument. It's really the fear. Like, you can say on the radio all you like, you can say truthful statistics like, you know, 1 in 10 million, 1 in 50 million. But as far as the general public is concerned, well, 1 in 10 million, that's, I'm not going to be that one, so therefore I'll follow all the guidelines. Yeah. It's up to scientists and it's up to politicians to step up to the plate and say this 1 in 60 million and 1 in 70 million, that these are facts and statistics that have to give us comfort, have to give us reassurance, and that we have to live in society on the basis of these facts and numbers. But the public fear out there is still so palpable, and it's being fed by people who are fond of the narrative for their own kind of private and political interests, that it's the public fear that is going to brand, you know, anybody who says anything against the narrative, as you rightly say, speaking through our arses.
Yeah. Dr. Marcus de Bruin is our guest. We learned today that the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine trial was suspended because a volunteer was taken to hospital. Now, the broadcast media, I can assure you, is not remotely interested in what happened to the volunteer. But the Daily Mail is, strangely enough, and they reported that the person had a serious spinal infection and didn't have any feeling in hands and feet, the person involved. Now, the broadcast media didn't want to hear about that, but they served up softball questions to the health secretary here. And he said, "Are those things are by the by. These things happen all the time during medical trials. Somebody getting as ill as that. What say you?"
Well, I say, look, you know, you're not going to, and I'm not going to convince people of who and who should not be getting these experimental vaccines. We're not going to convince anybody you're pissing into the wind and wasting your breath unless the fear in society is addressed. And unfortunately, when people are fearful, they don't listen to outliers. They don't listen to other siders or the other side. They listen to the people in charge, to the government and that sort of thing. So we're not going to, I don't think it's going to be successful trying to kind of tell people to approach vaccination rationally or that sort of thing. You know, I mean, all I can do is just remind people that medicine and science is being turned on its head because of fear. I've been vaccinated. I told you the last time I was on your show that I vaccinated my own kids. I've had all the vaccine myself, and I perform childhood vaccinations all the time according to the public health guidelines and schedule. I have no problem, generally speaking, with that. No problem whatsoever. And as I said to you the last time, I vaccinate newborn babies and that for diseases that you and I could get. But you don't get a vaccine for meningitis B. You don't get a vaccination for rotavirus because you may get this thing, you may get these infections, but they won't kill you and they won't result in an amputation or that sort of thing. They're not of a danger to you. So you don't get it. What medicine and what science does is vaccinate the vulnerable population. Well, which is the newborn infant in respect of meningitis or rotavirus. Now, that's open to, in all of my medical career, that approach makes sense. It's scientific based, it's empirically based, it's logical, it makes sense, and it's what I've been doing for 20 years. Now, fast forward to today, what I'm being asked to do from next week on is to squirt a novel flu vaccine up, you know, children's noses between the ages of 2 to 12. And I'm asked to do all kids, regardless of whether they need it or whether they don't need it. And, you know, this flu vaccine, it's a novel strain of a live attenuated vaccine, has nothing to do. It's not, this is not COVID. This has nothing to do with COVID. So, in two respects, how have we become convinced that we're going to vaccinate an entire population against COVID-19 when it doesn't kill the entire or doesn't affect the entire population equally? It's dangerous to a specific cohort of people, just like rotavirus and meningitis virus or meningitis bacteria are dangerous to a specific cohort. So we vaccinate the vulnerable. How has it happened? How are we in this situation now where in Ireland, most GPs around the country are going to be squirting this novel vaccine up children's noses? And how are we in a situation where we're going to be taking horrendous risks with national public health by injecting entire populations with vaccines when all of that is going against not just kind of basic medical science, but even common sense, you know? And my only answer, to make it a rhetorical question, my only answer is fear. That people are just full of an unrealistic sense of fear that's been fueled by politicians, for political reason, certainly obvious political reasons as far as I'd be concerned, and it's also been fueled and influenced by pharmaceutical companies.
Let me ask you this, Marcus. We've got Dr. Marcus de Bruin on the programme. Before we move away from vaccines and talk about something else which is pretty startling that came out of Boris Johnson's mouth today, I interviewed a GP from California, and he's been in private practice in California for some years. And he said, like yourself, for many years he's vaccinated according to public health guidelines, and, you know, against the measles, the mumps, rubella, rotavirus, meningitis B. And he's had a moment of pause, and he said, Richie, what I'd like to see done in the coming years is I'd like to see a target group of children not vaccinated at all, and then another group of children given the regular vaccines, and then to do a real study of them when they turn, I don't know whether he said 21 or 25, to see if the increase in the vaccine schedule, you know, has had any effect on kids at all. I'm guessing, I'm not putting words in your mouth, I'm not trying to Shanghai you now, but I'm guessing as a man of science, I'm guessing you wouldn't mind an experiment like that, would you?
Well, I mean, of course, who would mind an experiment like that, as long as it's conducted within the realm of public safety and public health, and that there was everybody's consented, and it's kind of, you know, and it's vetted and that sort of thing. No, I mean, you know, the minute you say the word vaccine, unfortunately, I've been labeled as an anti-vaccine.
And you're
nothing
not.
I can do. There's absolutely nothing I can do to defeat that slur. It's just out there, and that's it. But you know, I mean, what people have to realize, anybody who thinks that vaccines don't have side effects is really asserting something rather stupid, you know, because all they need to do is just open the bloody leaflet.
Read.
You know, there isn't a drug or there isn't a medicine out there that does not have side effects. It's the reason that they're in the pharmacy. It's the reason that vaccines aren't given by the local publican or the postman. They're given by doctors, and the drugs are in the pharmacy because these things all contain risk. They all come with risk. But we balance that by thinking, okay, well, how much risk is there and how many people are going to get it? So, you know, when we're in a situation where we're saying everybody is going to get the vaccine and people are going to get it who don't need it, we're certainly in a situation where, though the side effects that are inherent with all vaccines, every single time you stick a needle into somebody, there is a risk of side effects. Well, when we open that up and we open the floodgates and say, well, we're going to vaccinate millions and millions of people, well, then without a shadow of a doubt, you're going to have side effects experienced by a very large number of people. The real question here is, why are we going against the basic kind of rules of the game here? Why have they all been turned on their head? And as I said, the only answer I can come up with that is
fear,
the huge amount of fear that's out there.
Marcus, final word on that. The doctor in question, his name is Dr. Robert Rowan, MD, and he said, and he, like yourself, he takes a very academic approach, just like you, and he said, Richie, I don't know what would happen, but if I had to put some money on it, I reckon that the core group of kids not receiving anything would have more robust immune systems in their 20s than the kids who got them. But who knows? I just thought I'd throw that at you. Boris Johnson wants us all in the new year. You see, I'm not a medical man like yourself. I don't have any training like that. But I'm a history graduate, and I can't believe what I'm hearing out of politicians' mouths. He said that from the spring, they want a regimen in place where everybody in the country, every man, woman and child, would basically be tested every week for COVID. This is true, because by then they'll have a saliva test that will give a fairly quick result. And that will enable us to go into the future and get back to some semblance of normality. Who could... I mean, I asked you this before. It's a boring question. I know you're sick of hearing it. I'm scratching my head. I can't believe I'm living through this. I really can't. Yeah. What do you think when you hear that?
Well, you know, I mean, I suppose the people living in the UK are going to have to kind of, you know, do like yourself in terms of wait for history in order to get an impartial analysis of what's going on. I mean, I look at the Irish situation and I see it. It's fairly explicit to me, or fairly obvious to me, why we're being pushed down a road. There's quite a degree of political smokescreen involved in shielding the government from nursing home deaths. In terms of the UK, I mean, look, from my own kind of opinion or guess on things would be, as Boris Johnson did have a run in with COVID-19, and he had a run in and he was in hospital, and perhaps it hit him pretty hard, you know. But, and on that side of things, I think his own personal experience might be kind of, you know, overreaching into and interfering with an impartial objective analysis. But, you know, I mean, Boris Johnson has got some serious, you know, has at least openly declared some very serious health issues. I mean, I read in the media, I don't know if it's true or not, and perhaps it's not, but I read that he's used cocaine in the past. I think he smokes a couple of cigars in the past. He's certainly, like myself, he's certainly quite overweight, although I'm not quite overweight. I'm a little bit overweight, but he's a lot more overweight than I am.
He is,
so
yeah.
he's got a lot of poor health issues. So to operate on the basis that kind of his own experience, you know, with COVID, you know, and that might be kind of causing him to react and implement policies and ideas, you know, to across the board in the UK, I think his own experience and his own health might be influencing the type of kind of policy you're getting in the UK. But I mean, what Professor Carl Hennigan said from Oxford University, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Professor Hennigan and for Oxford University, and he gave a fantastic presentation on the efficacies of masks and that sort, and the policies that are in place, and they're of absolutely no benefit whatsoever.
Nobody cares,
so when you've got, I mean, I would take my guidance from Professor Hennigan rather than Boris Johnson, and I would take my guidance from Anders Tendel and the Swedish approach, who are pretty much at this stage now clearly vindicated in the national and international kind of media as having got it right. So, you know, I think history will eventually show that there's an awful lot of kind of personal agenda, political agenda, personal experience in this, and the science, the kind of science, logic and reason is being kind of pushed to one side or cherry-picked by people in power in order to hold on to their own kind of political power and their own political influence. So, you know, there's an awful lot of politics, but unfortunately the politics has been buoyed up by an awful lot of misplaced fear, you know.
When you see the Irish Medical Council, final question for you now, when you see the Irish Medical Council making claims that you were doing something which you weren't doing, I mean, I looked at it every which way, but Sunday, to see what you were doing, and you did exactly what you said you were doing. You said that you would address the rally and you would tell them basically what the advice on masks was. You certainly didn't encourage anybody to do anything. When you see that, when you see the media behaviour, when you see the politicians trying to transform our existence, our lives into something as dystopian, some part of you must think, well, there is some sort of agenda to transform society, to take us into a, you know, a dark kind of future where we are controlled in ways that we never imagined we would be. I mean, we've got to accept that possibility now, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if it's a kind of a, how would you say, a predetermined or a kind of a, I don't know if
or opportunistic.
There's a bunch of guys sitting around in a table who have kind of decided this 10 or 12 years ago. I'm not a kind of believer in that. I do think, however, that there's opportunism going on. I do think it's very, very strange in Ireland where, as I said, the leading proponent of masks and government policy is also a pharmaceutical boss who owns his own pharmaceutical company.
Yeah.
That, you know, when people were complaining about Donald Trump and that being elected, there was Cambridge Analytica, and it emerged that there was a kind of, you know, a sinister back undercurrent of control of the internet and control of the media, and there was control of people's minds and control of their kind of voting. Well, I think all of that is going on now, and it's going on right under people's noses in terms of the media, in terms of the internet, in terms of kind of universal vaccination, you know. And, you know, I mean, as a physician and as a microbiologist, before I was a physician, I can only stand up and continue to stand up and say this is fundamentally wrong. It's in total contradiction to basic science, to empirical reason, to logic. All we can do is stand up and say these things and you know, and try to align ourselves with the people who are making sense, like Professor Hennigan, like the Swedish approach, like, you know, all of the evidence is starting to kind of to build. But once again, you know, I think people are, you know, as this is an old saying to say, all is fair in kind of love and business. You know, I mean, it's not unreasonable to expect or to be surprised that pharmaceutical companies are moving into politically unstable zones like this and capitalizing on an opportunity. I mean, if you can, we've only got 650,000 people over the age of 65 in Ireland, but we've 4.5 million in the population, or 4.9 million in the population. So, of course, if a pharmaceutical company can engineer or at least piggyback on the fear and have 4.9 million people vaccinated, well, that's a huge big bonus. And this exact same in the UK. I mean, the UK has got about 12 million over 65s. But again, if a pharmaceutical company can turn that into a 50 million people getting a vaccine, there's a huge amount of financial interest at play here. And unfortunately, whilst the fear levels are so high, people are not seeing political motive. They're not seeing, you know, the pharmaceutical motive. They're not seeing the other side, and they don't want to listen to the other side. You know, so it's a little bit like, I think, you know, if somebody yells fire in the cinema, you know, nobody wants to hear a guy standing at the back of the cinema saying, hey, hold on a sec, there isn't actually a fire. Everybody wants to get out of the building in an orderly fashion and then figure out whether there is or isn't a fire. But unfortunately, I think it's going to be up to history to actually inform us of where we went right and where we went wrong because of the horrendous impact that social fear is having on people, you know.
Thanks for your time today. I know you're busy with your practice and everything else. I appreciate you coming on. I know it's difficult. I know you do it because you can't. You don't get these opportunities on radio and TV, as we've already discussed, but I do appreciate your time, Marcus, and sincerely wish you the best, and I hope we'll be talking again soon, and I hope when we are talking it'll be better news and maybe more common sense will have prevailed by then. But sincere thanks to you for your time today.
Hey, not at all, Richie, and look, thanks for having me on. You know, I think, as I said to you the last time, sure, look, you know, if this is the end of my career in medicine, then I've asked myself and continue to ask myself, is this the type of society I'd want to practice medicine in anyway? So, you know, I mean, I suppose it might be all for the best at the end of the day, so we'll see how it pans out anyway. But thanks for having me on, Richie.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Dr. Marcus de Bruin, you've heard him live from Rush in Dublin there, very respected GP who, you know, resigned from the Irish Medical Council in protest effectively at what happened in Irish care homes. And he's been bearing the brunt of that decision since. That's where we are today, sadly. Good to have him back on the programme. It's 3 minutes past the hour. What Dr. Robert Rowan, MD in California, told me 2 years ago, and that interview is on YouTube because it came after I opened the second YouTube channel. And I think it's still there. He said what he would like to do in the future is challenge the pharmaceutical companies and get a group of children, a good group of children, a study group. So you might have, I don't know how many he said, he might have said 100 children, he might have said 150. So you get 100, say, they don't get any vaccines at all, not from birth, right? And then you have 150 who get the regular scheduled vaccines. And he said, wouldn't it be interesting then, when they reach adulthood, to have a look at their general health and their well-being? And he said if he was pushed, he would have a bet that the ones who never received anything would be more healthy. Now, I've probably got a bit of cheek in saying this because I don't have any qualifications to do with medicine or anything like that at all. But I would say, yeah, you know, I would say that I'm 45 now and I think, apart from, I get the odd bronchial thing, and I was very sick a couple of years ago, and I was very sick this January just gone. But generally, I'm in good health. And my mates, who are my age or older, genuinely robust characters, you know. But I'm willing to bet that in 30 years' time, today's 15-year-olds, whom will be 45 in 30 years' time, I would be willing to bet they will be dealing with an avalanche of maybe not chronic, but nuisance type, debilitating maybe health conditions that I'm not dealing with today in 2020. I'll ask Robert Rowan, MD from California, to come back on the programme again, because that was an interesting chat and it's been a couple of years since we had him on. I think I wrote an article about him on richieallen.co.uk as well. Thanks again to Marcus de Bruin. I don't like... you know, I don't know whether I want to practice medicine in this type of world. You know, I don't like to hear that shit, you know. I don't mean he's talking shit. He's not talking shit. He's sincere. I understand it. So look, we've got John Kirby live from Stockholm in a moment. Let me just remind you of something I told you a bit earlier on. Vernon Coleman, Dr. Vernon Coleman, has uploaded a new video to Brand New Tube. It's entitled, This Fraud Is Now Blindingly Obvious, on Brand New Tube. And on vernoncoleman.com, he has helpfully prepared some text that you can convert into a leaflet on cashless society, which he's very worried about, and other things as well. So if you go to vernoncoleman.com, enter the website. On the left, there is a menu. Click on Health, and then you'll see very clearly the little article where you can see the text that you can copy and paste into your own leaflet. And I foolishly said to Vernon today, I'll get a printing press. But of course, ink is very expensive. So he said, don't be stupid. Just print one for yourself and then go to a photocopying shop or something and get them to do a couple of hundred for you. and do a mail drop Saturday afternoon or something. Go around and drop them in people's letterboxes, or pop into town centre and do it there. Let's have headlines from FSN. Why not have headlines? John Kirby will be with us in a minute. A life from Stockholm, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. Before that, though, it's off to FSN for the headlines. Has anything happened since we've been on air?
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The US plans to cut troop numbers in Iraq and Afghanistan to help meet President Trump's pledge to end America's endless wars. The British government is facing a growing backlash from members of the ruling Conservative Party over plans to overwrite key parts of the country's Brexit agreement with the EU. And fires have destroyed the largest camp for migrants on the Greek island of Lesbos, leaving 13,000 people without shelter.
This is the Richie Allen Show. Thank you, Simon. I appreciate that. It is broadcast live from Salford, Monday to Thursday at 5 p.m. UK time. It's Sunday mornings as well at 11 o'clock with Sunday View. It is live. You can hear it at richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2, TuneIn Radio on the TuneIn app, and triggerwarning.tv. And don't be listening to people saying, oh, Richie Allen is going to quit and all that. I'm not going anywhere. I enjoy doing this programme. And I'm resolved to keep doing it. All right? Change me mind like I change me underwear. We're approaching the 6th anniversary of the programme as well. More about that maybe. Not today, maybe tomorrow. Here's our hot chocolate. Sexual chocolate. And then we're off to Stockholm to John Kirby. Just admit one. Hot chocolate and So You Win Again on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Salford, there's still a bit of a stretch. There's still a bit of a stretch in the evening. That's a very Irish thing to say there. Still a bit of a stretch in the evening here in the northwest in Salford. 11 minutes past the hour. I'm looking forward to chatting with my guest this hour. I reached out to him in the last couple of days. He's an Englishman living in Stockholm in Sweden. And he posted a video on Twitter, I think on Twitter, that's where I saw it anyway, that's gone viral. A video about Sweden, which seems to be a much happier place, Stockholm appearing to be a much happier place than the northwest of the UK. People travelling on trains, not wearing masks, children mingling together, people going about their business. Of course, Sweden didn't take the approach to the lockdown, to the virus, I should say, that we took here in the UK. Let's welcome to the programme John Kirby. John, welcome to our programme. How are you?
Hello. I'm great, thank you. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. You've got a nice mic on your computer there. Thanks for coming on. Tell us, first and foremost, how did you end up in Stockholm in Sweden?
It was a long time ago. I met a Swedish girl who was working as an au pair in England. I think this was something like 27 years ago. And we were 5 years together in England. We married and then she was expecting a baby, and we decided to move to Sweden, quite simply.
Because the quality of life there maybe better for you, for the baby, and for your wife, of course. And yeah, I can understand that. Sounds good.
I think on her side, that's probably what it was. On my side, I mean, I really enjoyed the bits of Sweden I'd seen. And to be honest, I guess I wanted a bit of an adventure.
Lovely. I've never been. A friend of mine lives in Gothenburg, and he's from Waterford, like me, in Ireland, and he's never looked back. He loves it. Now, I was listening to Julia Hartley Brewer on Talk Radio this morning. She had the health secretary on, Matt Hancock. They got into a bit of a spat because Hancock kept insisting that Sweden has had 10 times more deaths than pretty much anybody else because Sweden didn't enforce a lockdown. Now, Brewer did her best, said he's talking nonsense and all of that, but they moved on. We have plenty of time to chat. Give us your experience of it. When he says 10 times the amount of people have died there, is there any truth to that? And what exactly has happened in Sweden?
We have these official figures, and I think the official figure is approaching something like 6,000 people in Sweden who have supposedly died of COVID. But I mean, at least the main Swedish version of BBC is called SVT, and they at least admitted on there that 85% of those deaths were not due to something, the supposed disease, but these were people that supposedly had the disease. Yeah,
people who might have been pretty thick anyway.
Yeah, so they had everybody. Like it was over 90% of those who died had two or more other major diseases. But they at least admitted that 85%. They can't say that the death was due to COVID.
And you're right to say that. And this was the point, I think, that Julia Hartley Brewer was trying to make to Hancock today. So for our listeners here in the UK and elsewhere who don't hear anything about Sweden unless it's on the BBC or Sky, go back to when this all began. As best as you can remember, John, I don't want to put you on the spot at all. I know you're not talking here now as a statistician. I know you're not, or as an expert. But what did the Swedes do? Was there any restrictions at all placed on you and your family at the outset back in March? What was the initial approach even, as you remember?
There was a big discussion. They were, I mean, because other countries were locking down or looking to lock down, there was a big discussion. There was a big parliamentary discussion around this, and they decided to trust on the healthcare services who said, no, this is not the way to go forward. They were looking at the whole health of everybody. They thought it would be a terrible thing for the children, for example, to not go to school. So that was, and this is something that's very big in Sweden, is caring for children. You know, children in many ways. So I think it's, you know, it's even more so than it is in the UK, that the children are seen here as being, like, you know, very important, and you know, you can never harm the children. So they saw that firstly as being, they can't close the schools. So they and we have remote parts of Sweden. If you go right up into the north of Sweden, you have Lapland, you know, and they actually have a sickness here, which is when we call it in back home, we call it cabin fever, but they call it lap sickness. And if you spend too much time by yourself, they realize it's very bad for humans, you know. So that there's something that I think they're aware of this, and they decided against the whole lockdown principle. So what they said, their advice was very simple, and it's pretty much the same today.
Thanks for that about the children. Thanks for telling us about the children and the approach of the Swedes there. And I'm guessing the Swedes at the outset, they also have a different approach to elderly folks. I mean, you know, John, because I know you're following this online and you've developed a big following yourself on Twitter. You're watching this. We locked old people into care homes, didn't look after them, didn't give them access to doctors. We didn't give them supplements that might have helped them. And worse still, we sent people out of hospitals who might have had viral infections or whatever. And that was very, very problematic for people in care homes here. But they didn't do that in Sweden. What I wanted to ask you, and again,
Can I interrupt there? Because that's actually not true. That's exactly how what happened here in Sweden as well. So they did empty the hospitals of the elderly,
right,
causing a lot of these deaths. And they did stop other elderly coming into the hospitals here as well. So we had similar problem.
So they did do that, because when you were talking to me about the cabin fever and the sickness and the isolation, I got the impression that they took a different approach to seniors, but they didn't. So they did the same thing then. That's interesting.
It's dreadful. They did the same thing, and they it's only recently that people could now visit their parents and stuff in the care home. So it's been a huge discussion here, and how they've treated the elderly. Yeah, it's been they are admitting they've done many, many crazy things.
Isn't that interesting again, that the discussion is happening in Sweden? It sounds to me, and again, no better man than you to answer this, it sounds to me like there's a bit more freedom of expression in Sweden than there is here. And I'm guessing your radio stations, commercially or otherwise or nationally, they sound, it seems to me like there's more room for dissenting voices. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest difference that I can tell is that the health service here is separated from the government in comparison to what it is in the UK. So they can, as a whole, as a unit, they can decide what's best for the Swedish people's health. Rather than what seems to be happening in the UK, it seems to be completely dictated by the government. And what the government says is what the NHS says, or the other way around.
And what's apparent to me from watching your video the other day, watching some of the other videos you've made, looking at the statistics, it's apparent to me, and I can say this honestly, not because I want it to be true, because I have looked at it myself, whatever authorities to be kind of triumphant, you know, to have a kind of a triumphalist approach to that. I don't know why we don't, but maybe it's because the media here doesn't want to talk about it. But I'd be screaming from the rooftops if I was the Swedish medical authorities. You know, I'd be saying, look, we didn't do that and we're in a much better place now than the rest of the world. Because you'll know, John, today they're calling for, you know, further restrictions in terms of people you can have living with you or not living with you, coming to visit. They're talking about testing for everybody in the country in the spring. It's going from bad to worse here, and things look to be pretty rosy in Sweden.
They do, but I have to admit that actually we have this big black cloud hanging over us as well. So, I mean, our media all along, I mean, I actually... I've had something that's called the Dagens Nyheter, DN, which is like the biggest serious newspaper here in Sweden, and it's won a lot of prizes. The way they've treated this whole crisis, I've been so angry with them, so I've actually said I need to leave. But because I sign up for a year, I have to have their newspaper every day for the next year, even though I signed up and got rid of it. Because they have really been pushing all of this, trying to do exactly the same. They're trying to scare the citizens here in Sweden exactly the same as they're doing in the UK. Wow. They're trying to push masks. They're doing everything. They obviously have an agenda to make us scared when people are no longer scared in Sweden.
This is horrible, John. John Kirby is an Englishman who's been living in Sweden for nearly 30 years, a businessman. And John put a video on Twitter the other day, which has gone viral. Hundreds of thousands of people have watched it. It was a lovely video. It wasn't in any way cocky or triumphalist. John was just saying, look, welcome to Sweden. It's a lot better here. You're shocking me, John. The fact is, it's we know that Sweden didn't do any worse than anybody else by not locking down. And yet there is this insidious agenda to bring into play the things that we're dealing with here in the UK. Now, tell me about the people you meet and interact with on a daily basis. Are they falling for it, John? Or are they sceptical like yourself?
I would say that most people here in Sweden are just blissfully unaware of what is really happening in the rest of the world. They just think the rest of the world has gone mad to some extent. So they don't really question anything because their lives are in no way really changed. So that because we're living in that bubble, you know, it's like the war is going on around us. And First and Second World War is exactly the same thing here. So they carried on life pretty much as normal. And that's how it is today. So it's like the world war is happening around the rest of the world. And Sweden still carries on life as normal. So it's really quite strange. So I'd say that most people are blissfully unaware. They just think the world has gone mad.
Do you know what, John? Because you didn't have the lockdown and because everybody didn't die, I would imagine it's going to be even more difficult than they imagined to convince the Swedes to go into some type of lockdown or to bring in some sort of restrictions. You'd have to imagine that, wouldn't you? Because the Swedes are not stupid now. They know that people didn't die on a massive scale. They didn't have lockdown. They didn't need it. So now to try and get them to think along the lines of restrictions, surely, John, that's going to be very difficult.
I'd say it's going to be very difficult now because, you know, if the, you know, with the normality of a pandemic, you know, it's, there's a big sort of like push and people get sick. And then, you know, then it's something that fades off, you know, over time, and people become accustomed to this, the body becomes accustomed to this, and you have this, is called, you know, herd immunity. But so how could they be scared again? I mean, this is the thing. I mean, my two youngest kids have been at school every day. There's nothing like social distancing or anything like that whatsoever. So it's and obviously if this was so contagious, you know, they would be bringing it back from school you know, would be sick over and over again. You know, if this was true and we can't build these antibodies, you probably detect that I'm a little bit suspicious.
I know. I'll ask you about that in a minute. And I won't jump all over you. I certainly won't attempt to embarrass you because I don't do that sort of radio. But I will point out to my listeners that you're not a doctor, nor are you a virologist. However, you have an opinion that is shared by quite a few of my listeners because I get it all the time about viruses. So I will ask you about that in a minute. And like I said, I won't attempt in any way to, you know, to embarrass you because I don't do that. We don't do that here. John Kirby is our guest. He's an Englishman living in Sweden. There's a song there somewhere, Sting. There's a song there somewhere. He's in Sweden. He takes coffee, not tea, my dear. He's in Sweden. And John put this video online. And it's lovely to have somebody on from Sweden to talk about this. The Swedes didn't lock down. And they didn't suffer accordingly. They did not. That's a fact. But John worries that there is a movement, there's a cloud, as you described it, a cloud hanging over the country, that there is an agenda maybe to move towards some sort of restrictions. Tell me, John, you must have a lot of empathy for parents of children in the UK, your parent country, because I hear from parents whom they're terrified about what these restrictions and constantly keeping people on tenterhooks is actually doing to the minds of the children. That must be really concerning.
Yeah, it's the reason I got onto Twitter, to be honest. Being a Brit and seeing what was happening to my brother's kids and to the rest of the country, I became very angry. So I actually joined Twitter 2012-13 or something like that, but I never found a reason to actually get involved with it until this happened. And when I started to see, I just wanted to find out what was really happening there in the UK especially. And that's what really got me involved into Twitter, is because I became so angry to at the response that was happening there. I even wrote to one of the MPs, Dominic, what is his name? Can you help me? Dominic?
One of the ministers, are you talking about? Dominic Raab, maybe, the foreign secretary. No, was it Dominic Raab?
Dominic Raab, yeah. He actually used to go to my school at Dr. Shannon's Grammar School in England. And, I mean, he was a few years younger than me, so I didn't actually know him, but I guess he would have known me because I was quite a known character at the time. So, and being him, you know, that he's a few years younger than me, I just wrote to him. But I said, what the hell are you guys doing? I mean, this is total craziness. I actually spoke about a headmaster who had recently died as well before this happened. So I had a reason to talk to him. And of course, he didn't answer me. So
he didn't send any reply back, which is pretty lousy. The secretary should at least acknowledge your letter. And I heard some children on national radio here recently. And they said, John, that these were children. Now, they were speaking pretty frankly, 10-year-old, 11-year-old children. And they said, we're a bit nervous about going back. We're very worried about breaking the rules. And some of them went on to expand on that. And they said they were worried about breaking the rules because of what it might mean for their older relatives. That's no way for a child to live, is it really? This don't kill granny nonsense.
It's absolutely dreadful. It's absolutely dreadful. I mean, as I said, that's what brought me onto Twitter because of my anger. What was happening to the UK, that was... You know, I've been somebody who has... You know, I have close to 1,000 friends on Facebook, but I've never done anything, you know, on social media because I've always, I don't really want to stick out. I actually have a famous company here in Sweden. So And I've not really wanted to push myself. You know, for me, it's been about my company, and I've always wanted to stand back. So I tend to naturally take a humble, more, you know, stand back type of attitude.
Well, you sound like a humble guy, Annie. I don't think you have to work too hard on the humility. But you're going into an area now that's very important in 2020. This idea now that expressing an opinion, which every human being on planet Earth is entitled to do, can these days have serious consequences for you personally and professionally. I mean, you will, of course, being on Twitter, you will have witnessed what happens to people whom say pretty benign things about political, you know, affairs or societal affairs. So you've got to keep that in mind. Of course you do. I mean, anybody would understand that.
Yeah. But my anger became so much that then I decided I don't care. So that's what pushed me onto Twitter. So then it was like, okay, I don't care anymore. This is much more important to me as a person that I dare to give my opinion.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. That was 3 months ago. So I've gone literally 3 months ago from zero followers to close to 9,000, I think, last time.
Yeah, and I understand that because parents are looking, they need the solidarity, and I totally understand that. And you don't have to answer this, of course, it's a little bit personal, but Mrs. Kirby shares the same concerns as you?
To be honest, I don't have a Mrs. Kirby at the moment.
Right, okay. see, you shouldn't have even answered that. You should have told me to mind my own business. But you know, I could say the children's mum.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. No, we'll leave that one alone. So John Kirby is live on the line from Stockholm. You can follow him on Twitter. 9,000 followers there and counting. You'll see the video. It's at John Kirby's, THLM. At John Kirby, STHLM. If you just look at my tweets today, you'll see I've tweeted John. Do follow him there. He's got a lot of interesting things to say. Now, I interviewed Robert Kaufman, MD, on the programme. And we talked about viruses and stuff. And he's of the opinion, Dr. Kaufman is of the opinion that, you know, there's a lot that we're not being told about transmitting infections. And I had a bit of an argument with him. I didn't really, because I'm polite, but I, as best as I could do, I said, look, I'm a guy who, whenever I'm in a room and somebody is sneezing and coughing and all that, give it 48 hours, John, and I end up getting the bloody bug, whatever it is going around. Infectious disease. Now, I know you're interested in this area. This is the last time that I will say you're not a doctor or you're not an epidemiologist. I've done my due diligence. You've got some questions about the whole area of viruses themselves. How did you get into that, and what is it that you think?
Well, I have to admit, I mean, I do have this company, and it's a big famous company in Sweden, but I have employed a CEO. So that means that my day-to-day work is taken care of by somebody else. And when this happened with the whole crisis, I started to question the whole thing, because it was going to be a big threat to my company. We sell experiences as a gift. And overnight our sales dropped 80%. So it was like it was going to be the end of my company. And I started questioning the whole thing. And I really, so I've been studying well over 1,000 hours looking into this. And I can, with the it's called the germ theory, actually.
Yeah, the germ theory, yeah.
The germ theory. And it goes back 150 years. And let me think, I can find the Frenchman's name. So I'm not very good at remembering names and stuff like this, but the Frenchman who was the guy that basically disproved the germ theory back 150 years ago, his name was Antoine Béchamp. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
You did. That's the one. I've got it here in front of me. I was frantically typing away just as you were there in Stockholm. So go ahead. Antoine Duchamp, yeah.
Yeah, and basically he disproved this germ theory back 150 years ago, and since then has been numerous top scientists that have questioned this, disproved it, and but I can tell you what I've found out is that more than 100 years ago, the company that was an oil company at the time is called the Rockefeller Company. It was the they were the richest guys in America at the time, and they took their, they thought, oh, we have this oil business and we have a lot of money and we're going to start inventing medicines. So they then, together with their oils, started with all the substances they were pulling out of the earth, started to create medicines. And exactly at the same time, they also started marketing themselves. They started disproving all the original natural medicines that the most Americans at the time, sort of going back to this turn of the, from the 1800s to the 1900s, they used natural products for their medicines. And they did this big marketing campaign where they basically poo-pooed everybody that was taking natural products and trying to push them to their petroleum-based medicines. And they actually were like the forefathers of the whole big pharmaceutical companies. And over those years, they've basically controlled the whole scientific world. So anybody questioning the virus germ theory that they push, they have silenced and both discredited, but even well, let us just say this: I'm not a detective either, but put it this way: that they happened to die, those people that questioned they as did. Well. So, yeah, this has gone on throughout this, at least this last 120 years. Anyway,
it's a very good summary of the theory, and I'm not just buttering you up. It is a very good summary of it, and I'm very interested in it. I'm very open-minded to it. The idea that we know about that particular organization, we know about the round table groups, we know about the Rockefeller institutions, and I've read the same notes as you have, this notion that they were able to basically discredit thousands of years of accepted knowledge about health and our bodies in order to introduce the concept of, you know, communicable diseases, which benefited their own agenda and the petroleum-based medicines you described. So I've read that as well, and I'm certainly not going to say that it's wrong, because I don't know. It is very interesting. I always come back to it, though, and I did ask Dr. Kaufman, and I'm not asking you to explain this at all now, John, but why do we, you know, if we work in confined areas, and of course most people do, why does colds and flus, and let's call them viruses, even though a lot of people don't believe in them, let's just call them viruses, why do they tend to run through places? I'm fascinated by that, you know?
Yeah, so there's two parts, as I understand it. So one is that we do have such things as bacterial colds, okay? So bacterial stuff, that can spread, you know? So like, you know, that we can get, yeah, the bacterial stuff can spread. So we can get sexually transmitted diseases, which are bacterial, and this is the same thing. So these can spread, but they're not viruses. This is something separate from viruses. How the viruses, the reason why people in the same areas can get viruses at the same time is because we tend, for example, as a family, to eat the same foods. We tend to be outside at the same times and taking in the same toxins, whether it's pollens, whatever it's coming into our body. These are the toxins. And at the time when the air conditioning or the air conditions allow, the body goes through a detoxing process where the toxins come out of the body, and this is why we get these flus and things.
Yeah, the idea of sharing an environment, and if you're sharing an environment with a group of people, you're ingesting, as you said, the same toxins, the same bacteria as they are. I'm fascinated by it, like you.
Some foods, probably, same lifestyles. Foods. You're often probably going to be the same sort of lifestyles. Yeah. You know, if you're not exercising well enough, you're not sleeping well enough, you're probably similar type of people in the family, even, you know, so obviously not everyone, and I mean, I myself had something that was blamed. I was 17 years old. I was rushed to hospital with a suspected heart attack in the beginning. I was rushed to hospital in an ambulance, and I was in intensive care for 1 week, and I was 3 weeks in hospital. I wasn't allowed to play sports for 3 months afterwards. So coming out of hospital, I had to be in a wheelchair, and I wasn't allowed to strain my heart at all. And this was given to me. It was told that I had a virus, and yet not one person in my family was sick, even let alone going off to hospital with a life-threatening disease. You know, that I was told I had a virus, and something. Obviously, understanding what I do today, something poisoned me.
Something poisoned you. And again, you are a successful businessman. I know the company. The company's called Livit in Sweden. I don't mind plugging the company at all. We can do that. And it's amazing to me that, and I said this to a guest last week, if none of this had happened, you obviously being up to your eyes with your children's lives, with your company and everything else, you'd have never, I would have imagined, correct me if I'm wrong, you could never have imagined that you'd be speaking about these things, let alone looking into them. Is that fair to say?
That's absolutely fair to say. And to be honest, you know, I didn't even really get involved in politics before this.
So can we give you a bit of stick then? Can we give you a bit of stick? Because would you have been one of those people prior to COVID that would have called people like us crazy conspiracy theorists? Don't lie to me, John. I know if you're lying.
It's 100% true. Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of friends from like Russia and Ukraine and stuff, and they told me a lot of stuff. And I promise you, I'm embarrassed to say they all of their conspiracies about 9/11 and everything that they told me, I just laughed at them. I just absolutely laughed at them. And now I'm apologizing because I've started to understand that the world is a very different place to what I thought it was. And the people controlling it, the science world is just one part of what they control. So when you actually understand the big picture of who these people are, and they've been controlling the governments, the countries for centuries, basically. So these people that I'm talking about, I'm not going to mention their names unless you ask me, they have been started every major war in the world for the last 400 years. They've killed the kings, they've taken over the religions, they've slowly taken over the politicians, and they own the central banks. They control the science, they control the education, they control the media, which is why you will not find doctors, and why you will not find anybody really questioning with any really good evidence questioning what's happening today, because they control all of these centres.
Don't apologise for a minute for calling people conspiracy theorists or for laughing at them. I'm serious. I did it, and I'm sure some of those who talked to you about the attacks on 9/11, I'm sure at some stage in their lives they mocked people as well. I worked in commercial national media. I was very dismissive of people who had opinions and theories about the City of London, the cartels, the Oppenheimers, the Warburgs, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers. When people brought these names up, I was the same. I said, stop, will you? Give over. You know, there's always a loony like you. So nobody needs to apologise to anybody. I think it's very humble of you to say, yeah, look, I've been affected by this, and it caused me to look into it. It must be terrifying, John, for people with businesses, with families to feed, with responsibilities. I mean, look at this. Look at what's... you'll be aware of this. Last week, more than half of the small to medium-sized businesses in this country said that they were at breaking point, and that they were definitely going to let people go in the aftermath of the ending of the furlough scheme. As a man with a successful business who rubs shoulders with people in lots of different businesses, I don't want to scare people, but people need to accept the reality. Give them an idea of the economic devastation, John, caused by this.
Well, I mean, we have literally survived by the skin of our fingernails to survive. Our year ended at the end of August, our financial year. So we've managed to survive. But it's because we put a large percentage of our employees here in Sweden down to 20%. And we were subsidized a big part of that by the government. So, but we've literally survived by the skin of our fingernails. And And the country is just a big version of a company. You know, you need the money coming in and the money comes out. You know, you have your expenditure, and when you have to pay for a lot of things and you can't just instantly get rid of them, which we can't here in Sweden. You can't just instantly just sack all the staff. You know, you have these expenses, and the money coming in, coming out, it runs out, and that's it. The company's over. It's closed. That's it. Well, everybody loses their job, and we've managed to survive so far.
Well, thank God you haven't. Speak up for bosses. I've never really been a boss, really, apart from one or two little interludes. And I've always been a bit rebellious, and I've always been a bit contrary, as we say in Ireland. So I'd have been a pain in the arse when I was younger if you were my boss, John. I'd have done a good job for you, but I'd have annoyed you regularly. You know, trade unionists like me, we often see bosses as the enemy, but bosses are not always the enemy. I'm guessing it hurts you thinking of employees and their responsibilities and how it impacts on them. You're a human being with a bit of humility. I'm guessing it doesn't come easy to tell people, listen, for the time being, we're going to have to maybe not offer you any work. I'm guessing that's pretty tough, John.
It is the toughest part of being a boss of any description. I mean, I'm one of these people that I like to be friends with everybody. So I consider the people that work with me as my friends as well, the people, my employees. And some of these employees, you know, you become very, very close to them. And the hardest part is to part ways. I mean, sometimes it has to be for a professional reason, you know, that they really aren't up to the job.
Yeah.
And that is such a difficult position to be in, because you know you love, you care for this person, but you have to say no. And when it's something like this that's completely out of your hands, you're being forced into closing the company. And to say to all these people that I'm sorry, but we're going to have to close the company. And I mean, we've been close to this a couple of times in our history, and it's a strange feeling, because I can honestly say that my feelings towards my employees, I'm more worried about hurting my employees' feelings than my own.
I believe you. I believe you, John. And because my listeners will kill me if I don't ask, how has the Swedish government helped, or what is it doing to try and help companies stay on their feet?
Yeah, so we've been subsidised. We get 50% subsidised. If they were to take 80% time off, so they still work. They wanted to keep people employed. So instead of just them doing nothing, we kept them at 20%. And they subsidize the company 50%. But I have to say that a lot of our employees, they still decided to work more than their 20% that they were paid for anyway. But and then we have now receiving some, because of the monies that we've lost, they're also compensating us somewhat. I mean, it's only a very small amount, but every little bit helps, to be honest. So. Yeah.
Thanks for speaking candidly about that, about the difficulties of that, because of course you have feelings for the people who have helped your company grow and be successful. Just to remind our listeners, we've got John Kirby on the show tonight. Some of you will by now have seen John's video where he talked at a train station in Stockholm. He talked about how Sweden is, you know, thriving and alive, and no masks on public transport, no masks on children. You know, no restrictions. People are going about their business. John's in Stockholm. He's been there for nearly three decades. He's got a company called Live It. And he's obviously originally from the UK. And it's very important to get this. William is in Scotland. How you doing, William? We've got about 5 minutes left on this. William says to ask John what the story is in terms of the vaccine in Sweden. So in other words, would you be hearing a lot now in Sweden, as we are here, about vaccines, and does that concern you?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm not following that much. I have my newspaper They've been talking about the vaccine from the start, and the same as, you know, all the leaders of the countries, they said that, you know, that the vaccine, you know, they need to wait for the vaccine and this sort of stuff. But I'd say the general public is not very sold on the fact of a vaccine.
Good.
And we had the swine flu scare, you know, the same as the rest of the world, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And there were a lot of people damaged by the swine flu vaccine that was given to people in Sweden. So people are critical somewhat to the vaccine idea.
People got narcolepsy, John, didn't they?
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
That's a fact. And today, I had a doctor on the program before you, an Irish GP, and I asked him about it, and, you know, he was careful, but also very honest in his answer. Today, they suspended AstraZeneca Oxford trial because some poor, unfortunate creature took exceptionally ill with a spinal infection and loss of feeling in their feet and hands. I mean, I don't tell people what to do, and I wouldn't be classed as an anti-vaxxer. There's no way I'm taking anything that they've rushed through in a few weeks or in a couple of months, John. Madness.
No, exactly. I mean, this new one that they're talking about for the COVID vaccine, and because they're also pushing the flu vaccines, at least the UK is really pushing the flu vaccines. But the COVID one, it's a new vaccine that's never been created before. It's called an RNA-based vaccine.
That's right.
Never created it before. And as I know your guests before have said, you know, to actually create a vaccine that could be properly seen to be as safe, you're looking at a 10-year process.
10 years.
To really see, to really judge, and there has to be so many things that they need to do. So of course, there's no way that they can push anything out that is going to be any way safe, not proven safe at least.
Do me a favour, John, stay in touch with the programme. I've really enjoyed listening to you this evening. It's been a pleasure to have you on. I'll give you the final word, of course, in a second. I always do. You can follow John on Twitter. If you look for John, J-O-N Kirby, you'll find him pretty quickly anyway, but it's John Kirby, S-T-H, is it L-M or I-M?
L-M. Shortened version of Stockholm.
That's the one. John Kirby, S-T-H-L-M, all one word. I'll send a tweet out after the show thanking John for coming on. So you'll find that tweet and just follow John there. And we do hope that things will improve there. We hope that the doom mongers and those who want to bring about restrictions in Sweden will be confronted, because again, you know, please God, it must be difficult for them, because Sweden didn't have a lockdown. Swedish people are not stupid. So let's hope that there's a real fight against that there. And we do hope that your company survives and that you'll be able to, you know, re-employ staff there. I'll give you the final word. Well done on making that video. And thanks for coming on, John. I've enjoyed having you on. Final word to you.
I'm very thankful to be given this time to talk to you. I mean, I've followed your show somewhat these last few weeks. It was a friend of mine here that got to hear about it and who told me about it. And yeah, I mean, I would say people don't trust the governments. I don't trust the media. What I've learned, they're not having our best at interest. So don't trust them. And this new vaccine coming forward, whatever you do, do not take this. Whatever you do, don't allow anybody that you love to take this.
John, thanks for coming on this evening. Have a lovely evening there in Stockholm. Nice to meet you. And I'm sure we'll talk again.
Cheers, Richie.
All the best for now. How cool was John? Really nice to get him on the programme. Met him on Twitter, saw the video, and said I'd invite him on there. Very candidly speaking about, you have to mention it again, coming from a place where you would have been dismissive of and even condescending to people whom would be asking questions about historic events and challenging those narratives, you know, around, for example, obviously 9/11, JFK, of course, and the Second World War. What I mean by the Second World War, of course, is, you know, the companies that supported Hitler, how the European Union came out of that. We've talked about it so much, you know, the Club of Rome, the Rockefeller Foundations, the round table groups, and I mean, I would have been very, as I've said many, many times in the past, when I was in commercial radio at the very beginning, I would have been very dismissive of... I was never rude. I never laughed in people's faces and said, you're an idiot. I've never done that. You know, I would have just ignored and just yawned and said no. So very humble for people to say, well, look, I've had to have a second glance because personal circumstances mean that I've had to have a second look. So I do really appreciate that. A lot of comments came in there. Bass Ninja, who we've spoken to, of course, on the phone-in show, friend of ours based in Liverpool, he said, you know, that he's had the same approach towards his own boss. He said, Richie, with what John has just said, that's why I'm not angry at my employer who has been forced to make people redundant to try and survive. But I guess it'll go tits up before April if the tyranny continues, he says there. Really appreciate that. Hi to Faisal. How you doing, Faisal? Hi to Grant. How you doing, Grant? Hi to Tiger Johnson. How you doing, Tiger? David Stanford is listening. Just for a bit of balance. How are you, David, by the way? David says, Richie, I'm not having germs theory as it stands today either. Or this isn't balance. I think he agrees with John. Or it would be germ law, not theory. An unproven, agreed upon idea can eat a... And then he uses an expletive. He says, dick. Fair enough. Cool. Jason has a very good question. And if we had more time, we could have gotten into it. He would have been interested in John's opinion as to why those who do control things allowed Sweden not to lock down. That's a good question. If every other country was in lockstep, and if it is a group of people, or, you know, if it is a certain cabal or cartel making the decisions that everybody else follows, why not Sweden? Good point. Yeah, we might get into that again in the very near future. Good question, Jason. I appreciate that. Hi to Nicky O'Brien as well. And I could be here all day saying hello to people. Right, that's about it from me. VernonColeman.com, left-hand side of the page. Once you enter the website, there's a menu. Click on Health, and from there you will see Vernon's text or a link to the text for the leaflets. If you want to hand out leaflets warning people about cashless society or something else, Vernon has already done the legwork for you. You can make a leaflet and then have it copied by somebody and distributed as a means to dealing with this, as a means to trying to get people to have a second look at it. All right. And Brand New Tube, by the way. Brand New Tube is where the new home for an old man in a chair. Brand New Tube. And the new video published today is "This Fraud Is Now Blindingly Obvious." Vernon, of course, Dr. Vernon Coleman, will be on the programme with me on Mondays from here on in, as long as he wants to do it, at 5:30 p.m. Regards, by the way, to Antoinette tonight as well. Thanks to Dr. Marcus de Bruin from Rush in Dublin for his courage. And thanks again to John Kirby, the businessman living in Sweden. That's it for the programme. Going out with a little bit of Otis Redding, with a sentiment, I think, that no harm at all. Try a little tenderness. See you tomorrow at 5 on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Until then, enjoy the rest of your Tuesday.
Oh, she may be weary.
Or Wednesday, you dipstick.
Them young girls, they do get weary.